Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number 646. I am doing a bunch more shows. Second shows for the Fun Comfortable Tour have been added in Atlanta and Philadelphia and D.C. and Boston. And then a bunch more cities are about to be added for the rest of the year. So there will be some Texas dates. And so check that out at funcomfortabletour.com. Let's pop over to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Blah, 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 blah. The Monster Popcorn Podcast would love for people to listen to their show. They discuss a movie every 2 weeks, dish out their own brand of insight, and try to keep things fun and interesting. They can be found online at monsterpopcorn.com. They're on iTunes, TuneIn, as well as Facebook, and Monster Pop HQ on the tweets. Also, Brandon Holthouse is hosting the 5th annual Pat's Crohn's Crew Benefit on April 19th in Baltimore, Maryland. He says his grandmother passed away in 2011 at the age of 77 due to Crohn's disease, and he and his family have hosted a benefit in her memory every year since she passed away. All the money raised goes to support the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America. To make a donation, we're going to put a link in the description of this very episode. And finally, a young fella by the name of Andrew Derry has emailed events@nerdist.com, as you can too, to make the community corkboard. I've been a big fan for a while. Love you guys. My name is Andrew Derry. I just released my first short story on Amazon.com. Could you please mention it? The name of the short story is Last Eden Echo Book 1. And again, it's on Amazon.com. You can also find it on Facebook.com/Echo Stories. This episode is Michael McKean, and I'm sure you can imagine that it was difficult to suppress the comedy nerd from spewing out. Michael McKean has been in several of my favorite things of all times across all platforms. And he talks about a lot of stuff, a lot of great Spinal Tap stuff I hadn't heard before that we talk about. But two things I forgot to mention. I forgot to mention The Big Picture, which is one of my favorite movies, but I just forgot to mention it. If you haven't seen it, you should. Christopher Guest directed it. Kevin Bacon, Michael McKean, Martin Short. And also Zork the Grand Inquisitor. He plays Dalbaz of Girth, who basically is your narrator he's your guide through that game. That is one of my favorite games of all time, Zork the Grand Inquisitor. And I haven't found an emulator to be able to play it recently. So if you have some suggestions for that, please let me know. But he is promoting Better Call Saul, which is fantastic, by the way. If you've not been watching Saul, you absolutely should. That's on AMC Mondays at 10 p.m. I was nervous. I didn't know if people were going to be like, I'm such a Breaking Bad fan. I don't know how I have room for Saul in my life. And you know what? There is room for Saul in your life. The show is fantastic. Odenkirk's killing it. And McKean is great. And he's also super fun on this podcast. And now here's Nerdist Podcast number 646 with the brilliant Michael McKean.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Dickens, you know.
Do you know Patton could actually like his output is high.
But then it would mean he wouldn't. He could probably.
He needed to do stand up too.
He's also got a child, you know.
He does. That does take up a lot of extra comedy writing time. Because I remember Patton would. I remember one time in particular where I did a show with him on a Tuesday, and the following Tuesday he had 20 completely new minutes. Well, that's all amazing.
No, he's completely inventive. But the thing is, a book needs a premise, and once he locks into that premise, he kind of has to mine there for a while.
That's true.
He can't go. He can't suddenly go, hey, you remember when, you know, and he can do that on the stage. But a book is a certain kind of thing, you know.
Right.
He's writing a book ostensibly about his film addiction.
Right.
It's really just about Patton's years between 1995 and 2005 or whatever it is. And it's just interesting.
So what I say is, prove us wrong, Patton. Write a book a week.
Write a book a week.
What are you afraid of? Why are we calling out?
Who is covering up? Yes.
Seriously.
What are you hiding, Patton Oswalt?
Are we okay for sound?
We're good. Are we good? Katie, we good? Everything's good. Right. I am so beyond excited and thrilled and freaking out to meet you in person.
Beyond all those lie death.
No.
So please be careful.
No, I intentionally left the writer's room to come do this podcast. A lot of times I will.
I was
going to
say it's a little cluttered in here.
It is a little. That's all right.
I better go.
Like that.
I better go.
And it's not even as cluttered as it could be because there's usually a third guy on the podcast.
You ever notice those morning shows? Maybe you just don't encounter them too much. The morning radio shows, if you've ever done live appearances, you go in you walk in and you count the number of people in the room and you go, it's going to be 9 shitty. Or 11 shitty.
Levels.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you go, what market am I in? Where am I again? Oh, yeah, I'm there.
Hey, Michael McKean, do you remember when you were in that movie, Spinal Tap?
That would be great. Instead, the main guy is like,
what's the deal with that?
I mean, it's that guy. It's the guy who's already swallowing his kidneys.
You know, he's saying what we're all thinking. What is the deal with that? I mean, to succinctly break it down into its philosophical basics.
Well, I don't listen to people talking in the morning too much, unless it's the Goon Show.
Of course.
that's talk, baby.
That is the best.
No, but mainly I listen to music when I'm, you know, in control, like in my own car and stuff. But, you know, there's that thing. There's that job you have where you're basically reminding people what time it is and how late they're going to be. And
that traffic is on the twos.
Door. Yeah, and what the traffic is. Exactly right. So it's just not really for me.
We sent our intern to go buy a vibrator. It's like, oh, God.
And it's sent to your mom's house.
Oh, come on. This guy. I don't even know. My favorite story about doing, because I've had to do a million of those too. And there was one in Texas. I think it was Texas. And if you listen to the show, you thought there were like 9 guys on it. But it was one guy doing like 7 different character voices. And to see them in person, I was like, well, they all sound like they're coming out of the same guy. But when I went and did the stand-up show that night, people were like, did you hear the one guy arguing with the other? They had no idea that it was the same guy. I'm like, how can you people not know it's the same guy?
Well, that was the genius of Phil Hendry.
Yes.
When he was really interacting, I mean, he's still a genius, but when he was interacting with people on the phone, and he would have 3 completely fake people in the studio with him or on the line with him. And then he would haul in somebody who's listening and saying, did he just say that whatever it is, that Babe Ruth was black or whatever the premise was, the guys, and they'd get on and he'd fight with these guys. And then as Phil himself, he would moderate the argument, you know, between, you know, his 2 made up people that he's also doing and the real person on the line. It was just awesome.
And you'd always think, at this point, people know. Like, they must know. And then, but he would always find people that they would always stumble across it and have no idea.
Well, the way he put it was, the people who listen to me, meaning Phil Hendry, are not the people who generally listen to one thing all the time. They just go with their radio dial until they find something that sounds angry, and they stay with it. You know, and it's true. It's like you find the suckers. You find the people who are taking life very seriously, and they always their mouths are wider than anyone's for the big hook.
Yeah, Tom Likas was an android that was engineered by Industrial Light and Magic. He was not actually a real
That's
person.
That's true. That absolutely true.
Well, it actually took 45 people to operate.
45 people to operate the puppet of Tom.
So not really cost efficient.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
They didn't have medical, though. No medical coverage.
It sounded amazing.
It cost $240 million a year to run that radio show. And in the end, I don't think it was worth it. But, you know, I'm not
Tom
a radio
Likas
guy anymore, so who knows.
Yeah.
But you're on Saul now.
Yes.
You're about to be. You've done it, but now it's about to air.
Well, yeah. It starts Sunday night.
Sunday night.
The 8th. of February.
Yes.
And the second episode is on the next night.
Yes, because I normally do a show in the time slot that Saul's going to be on, and they're sliding us back an hour to premiere Saul right after Walking Dead, which I think is a very smart idea to get eyes on it. And one thing that I know Vince has been saying to a lot of people is like, everyone, it's not Breaking Bad. I just want you to know it's not Breaking Bad. So it's a different story, different guy. So everyone,
very good.
Oh, I love Vince. Oh, man. So everyone should understand that it is a different. It's, you know, if you're watch to watch, especially if you're a Breaking Bad fan, but don't go, how come there's no ...
It's, first of all, Breaking Bad was, for all its myriad wonders, was also a crime show, a show that revolved around crime.
Mm-hmm.
This is a show that revolves around the law and the practitioners of the law. It's just, it really is, it's a slightly different angle. It's also 6 years before the before 2008, the beginning of the Breaking Bad years.
Right.
So, you know, Saul is Jimmy McGill. he's not Saul yet. So, you know, I think that it's going to be very interesting to see people take a run at this. And, you know, there will be people who will never forgive this show for not being Breaking Bad.
Right.
Or not being Breaking Bad 2. But Vince had always talked about this. He had always talked about going back with that character, with Saul, into his roots.
Right.
So, anyway.
If anyone could do it, I think, even with the cast, but Vince... I just adore that guy.
Yeah,
He's so brilliant and lovely. And
he is. I did a couple of X-Files that he wrote. And he wrote he and Frank Spotnitz and a bunch of others. The way I don't know how they worked things at X-Files, but it was a show I really liked. And then, you know, all of a sudden I'm doing this show, and it was a two-parter and everything. And it was this, everyone seemed to be really enjoying doing what they did, like I thought people always would. And people on a set are not always really, really digging what they do.
Right.
And there are a lot of people who've been at the same job, say at a studio or something, and it's become kind of like working a press. You know, it's really, there's that kind of ennui that sets in. But these are people who are saying, hey, we're getting to make movies. And they had the money for it. Because X-Files looked great.
Yeah.
I mean, every week it was like a little movie, you know. So I was just really impressed with them. And you know, Vince and I talked, over the ensuing years and, you know, about doing various things. And I was usually not available or it didn't work out, whatever. And this time it just worked out. It's very nice.
Well, if someone were to go to your IMDb page, it is probably one of the more extensive IMDb pages.
I'll never catch up to Mel Blanc.
You can't possibly.
You cannot catch Mel Blanc.
He didn't have to physically go anywhere.
No, and he was the only person who got credit in cartoons in those days.
Yeah.
Ever.
So he could literally knock out a bunch of different, you know, it would take you a year to do jobs. He could crank them out in an afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever
seen... It's not fair. Fuck that guy. Why are we getting mad at Mel Blanc?
There are some sites with musicians' credits on it. And you look at some of those guys, and there were guys who literally did 500 sessions a year.
Jesus.
Wow. Wait, what? Session? Well, it might have meant, you know, just coming in and laying a part on top of this Frito-Lay commercial that, you know, we're not quite happy with. We need a little extra lead guitar, but... No. Double scale, whatever his usual rate is, and he goes down the road. You know,
I would love to know what really amazing guitarists are like. Is Stevie Ray Vaughan secretly on like a Dove commercial?
Well, Stevie Ray Vaughan played the lead guitar on David Bowie's Let's Dance.
Yeah,
yes, he did, and that's used in. We hear that
all the time. But the Vic Flick is the guy that was sort of everywhere. He played the. He played the guitar tone you hear for the James Bond theme.
Oh,
Yeah. He also helped Jimmy Page out in some sessions. He also played on the orchestral soundtrack to Hard Day's Night. All the music that you would hear that was interweaving, that was Vic Flick also.
So was he, but he was freelance. He wasn't signed because those were all different studios.
He do all these different things in England.
It's too bad that Rick Flick never worked with my friend, the bass player, Bob Glaub.
Vic Flick and Bob Glaub.
Real guy.
Guys together.
I'm actually, he's an awesome bass player.
Yeah.
And his name is Bob Glove. So Rick Flick.
Vic Flick, excuse me.
By the way, that is a great name for a bass player because a bass is kind of globby.
It's kind of bobby.
And it's all about with Vic Flick. It's the flick of that wrist.
That's right.
Flick and glob. Yeah. No one would believe, like if you pitch that I want to do a sketch about a guitar player named Flick and a bass player named Glob. You're like, that's hacky. That's so on the nose.
Well, let's not write it then.
Let's just say
we've had that experience and we move on with our lives.
Let's get past it. I was a huge fan of I had the Lenny and the Squig Tones because Dr. Demento played Foreign Legion of Love. So when I was growing up, and you guys were fantastic, like a really great musical. I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously people know that they know about Spinal Tap, but I think more people should dig deeper and see that there is a farther reaching history of musical comedy in your past.
Well, I suppose.
Did you not? You don't think so?
Well, I wanted to make a garage band album. I didn't want to do a live album. You know, I wanted to just like really put it out, really small form, and make it look like these guys actually did it, like it was DIY.
Yeah.
You know, and I said no, because the Blues Brothers album was a big hit, and Neil Bogart of Casablanca says no, it's like you got to do a live album. And it was okay. It was okay. But you know what? In those days, in the late 70s and early 80s, the music business was a little wakey-wakey, if you know what I mean. And people kind of wore you out. Uh-huh. And Casablanca was an incredible place. It was up on Sunset. And you would go in, and I actually went in there one time with David and our manager. Or
David whoever, Lander. Yeah.
David Lander. One other person, and we walked into the Casablanca building. We had been working there for a while. We'd been working on the thing, hadn't come out yet. And it was the day that Hot Stuff broke, the single. The day the single dropped, Donna Summer's Hot Stuff. And I swear to God, as we walked in, it was a courtyard situation with two stories. And it's like, you know, built like, kind of like a motel, which is probably what it originally was. But it was the record company. You walk in there and it's blaring from every speaker. Wow. And everyone is dancing. Literally everyone was dancing. It was like the opening that one might have imagined for Can't Stop the Music 2.
Of course.
You know, oh my God. Sweeping and there we were.
Is that the Village People movie?
It was the Village
People. I remember that movie.
Yes, indeed.
Were you in that?
No.
Okay.
we had severed ties with Casablanca by that time. That's an amazing movie.
It is. Bruce Jenner's in it.
Bruce Jenner. And, Steve Gutenberg.
Steve Gutenberg's in it.
And Valerie Perrine.
Perrine.
Yes, whatever. Yes, and the Village People. And
who people might also know is Miss Tessmacher. From Superman?
I really thought you were going to say who people might also know as the policeman, the Indian chief, the...
Well, that's from the solo albums they did. I remember them.
The theoretical creation of the Village People in Can't Stop the Music. That movie...
Oh, it's God, amazing, isn't it?
I saw it when I saw it when it came out, and... And it was around a time when like band movies like Sergeant Pepper's, which was not a great movie, came out with the Bee Gees and so they did not have a great success rate with the, you know, here's a fictitious account of how a band got together.
Yeah. Boy, those are the days. Now, of course,
Kiss had one.
Yeah,
that was crazy.
Was there a Kiss? How Kiss Got Together movie?
There was a Kiss movie
starring Kiss.
Yeah. But I feel like there was an element where an evil scientist created a robot Kiss band.
Yes, Phantom of the Park.
Wow.
Originally called Phantom of the Palisades or Phantom of Palisades Park. One of those. And Palisades said,
please don't.
We're not like Kleenex. You can't just use it whenever you want.
Please don't put that indelible stamp.
Wait, was that the one that Paul Williams is in?
Paul is in Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, he's in Phantom of the Paradise. Yeah,
yes, I got my Phantoms
completely
mixed
different,
up,
like weird 70s rock opera movie.
He's a nice guy.
He was just on a couple days ago. Paul
really?
Such a sweetheart.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy. I've run into him maybe 5 times in my life, and he was always kind of. Yeah, you know, boy, you're kind of an impressively nice man.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, because when he was younger, he was he had some issues to work through.
But yes,
and then
he did.
Thankfully, he survived those and became
unlike other child actors.
Did not
never.
It's
never.
Not. It rarely. No. It rarely works out.
No,
I would like to see the theoretical construction of Justin Bieber as a movie about how he is the collection of. Just I feel like there's a Gargamel laboratory somewhere where someone put.
Imagine how much he would be worth if he were still in the original package.
I mean, you know, they made such a Canada really fucked that up when they took him out of there.
Yeah.
They should have left him in his mother, which would have been the original packaging.
Left him in his mother.
Is that too literal?
No.
Okay, good.
It's uncomfortable, but okay, good. It's not good, too good. Literal.
I'm okay with that.
Okay.
So when because initially
you notice we never really seem to talk about anything. I'm kind of liking that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about something specific?
No. We keep meaning well, but it's more interesting to talk than it is to be interviewed.
Well,
to be honest
this,
with
Michael,
you, so I hope you're okay.
We don't
with
interview
that.
Really. We have conversations.
I know. I've heard.
And let me just give you the matrix code behind how I do this. I know a lot of things, particularly about you, and I will start bouncing around those things. And then eventually we'll find something that will dig deeper, much in the way that you would in a conversation.
All right. I would add this proviso.
Please.
It should be something that you really want to know.
Okay.
And if it isn't, I'll say you don't want to know that.
Okay. All right. Great. That's fair.
Well, I would have done anyway.
But what if I was like, but now I really want to know. And you're like, does that then count?
Then it'll be okay. I will
say the most I ever spent on a DVD was the Criterion Spinal Tap, which went out of print. And I had
that's with
the in character and out of character commentary. The in character is the one that they have on everything.
Yes,
the Blu-ray release has the in character, and I was like, I want to hear that was great, and then I wanted to hear the out of character one. And I remember it was like $82, and when I first moved to L.A., it was in one of the cases at Amoeba,
right?
And
do not steal.
And I was like, I couldn't afford it, and then It was only like 3 years ago where I finally was like, I'm going to walk into that and buy that DVD, and I have it, and it was everything I ever wanted it to be.
Well, thank
but it was
you.
$120 by the time I bought
Holy
it.
Holy hell.
Inflation.
Oh, my God. Well, you know how much Superman number 5 costs now? At the time, it was a dime.
But it's gone up.
It's gone
It's
up.
Actually less. The part of it was actually less, like 8 cents.
Yeah.
I would love to hear a little bit about... the credibility gap. Okay. I would love to hear about your early days with Sketch.
Yeah.
Because I know you and David were in a group with Harry Shearer.
Right.
And so I just want to hear what got you, especially at that time, were you inspired by like Firesign Theater? Like what was it that made you guys go, hey, we're a sketch comedy group and in the 70s we can go do something with that?
Yeah. Well, the first real exposure to sketch comedy was probably Beyond the Fringe for mm-hmm. me. And it was very British, and I didn't get a lot of it. When I was, 12, 13, whatever, 13 or 14, let's say. But I thought, oh, this is really economical. They don't have to dress up so much, and da-da-da-da-da, and I get the idea. And I would just see pieces on TV. I didn't see it in a theater. At college, I did a little bit of it with Chris Guest, and I weren't in the same group. We were just in, arbitrary groups. We were both studying acting at NYU. And so we were friends, and, we wrote songs together and everything, but we didn't really interact because we didn't have the same classes. But this guy, Tom Leopold, who is maybe he's a producer, writer, novelist, very, very funny man. I did a lot of stuff in Omar Chaplee's improvisational class. It was a class called Games Improvisation. So that was kind of fun. Then I got to L.A. because David Lander, whom I had met at Carnegie Tech earlier. Carnegie Tech is what they called it before the Mellon money came
sure,
in.
Sure, sure.
And so he was working with these guys on this radio show in L.A. So in 1970, I came out to L.A. And I became kind of a frequent guest, It was Richard Beebe, David L. Lander, and Harry Shearer were the main, the main flyers. And I was the stowaway. So, eventually we were all working on an FM station. We got a little freer, and we started doing stuff. That was the credibility gap. They actually started in 68. A guy named Lou Irwin and Len Chandler, who was a singer-songwriter. And it was like kind of a precursor to what it became. Because Harry and Richard and David and myself were all really into that kind of radio comedy, especially Harry, who had been on the radio since age 10.
As soon as that voice dropped, he was in.
Yeah. He was on the Jack Benny show. He was one of the Beverly Hills Beavers, the Boy Scout Monkeys.
Wow.
So, he's that guy. He just really knows radio. So I kind of became a radio comedian. And then, to expand on our lack of success, we want to exploit it, as it were, we decided to go onto the stage in the early 70s, 72, 3, 4. We did a lot of stage work, opening for big rock acts and headlining on our own coffee houses and places like that.
That wasn't. And how was that going? How was comedy opening for rock acts going at the time?
It depended very much on who the act was. The worst experience, we opened for Richie Havens. Okay, Richie Havens, not terribly well known. He died a couple of years ago. Very big, kind of well put together black guy, you know, who really kind of still had the feel of a street singer, which is kind of what his persona was, and it was kind of where he was from. And he sang a lot of big ballads. You look him up. He's an interesting character. But he was very much for an audience full of people, especially in San Diego, it was about half sailors and half just greasers and and a lot of hippies. And
it never goes well when a population is half sailors and something else.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, they were guys. That's what you find in San Diego. And a local market gave everyone an orange on the way into the gig.
Sure.
So they weren't crazy about us.
Oh.
And we saw some orange action. We had
never give the audience a projectile.
It wasn't our idea. And Richie was very nice, and his entourage, which, four or five guys, just kept looking at us like, that's so sad that you have to do this. But we had a little signal, and it was like a trapdoor signal. If we were in the middle of a sketch and the audience was either yawning or yelling at us to get off or throwing oranges, in this case, we would just do this little nod, and we'd cut right to the last number, right to the last piece.
Oh, interesting.
Which was a musical number, and we couldn't hear them anymore. Which usually ended with David Lander going, "Fuck you, ladies and gentlemen. Fuck you very much. Fuck you all. You're less than kind." And then off we went.
My favorite part of watching Michael do that is the fact that there was a real microphone in front of him. He chose to pantomime the microphone.
Yeah, that's right.
You caught me. You can take the guy out of the sketch theater, but you can't take the sketch theater.
No.
He's going to do space work.
You know what? If I had a hairbrush, I would have used that. So fuck you.
Fuck you, man. Fuck you very much.
A life dream come true.
So then how do you guys go? I mean, with Laverne and Shirley, were you pitched as a sketch duo? Or
no.
How did that work?
Well, we were doing the act, and Richard Beebe left the act. It was just, we were the power trio of Shearer, Lander, and McKeon. And we played the improv when it was just first breaking in as the improv. Mm-hmm. Before that, we had done in 74, when Nixon was resigning, when that whole Watergate thing was happening, we had kind of a residency at what is now the improv. It was called the Pitchell Players at the time. Long story. And so we got to cover all that on a daily basis. So it was like ripping and reading the news, which is what we used to do at the radio stations when we were doing news sketches. And it was really, really fun. So it was like, there was a time briefly where the satire was kind of concentrating on us. We were the epicenter because we were, we were transmitting the same thing that people were reading in the paper. It was really nice and everything. And toward the end of that time, it was sort of, well, now what? Now what do we do? And we did, we did radio commercials. We did a couple of other commercial things. And then Penny Marshall sold this show. She did. She and Cindy Williams had done these two characters on Happy Days, and her brother Gary Marshall, and Lowell Ganz and Mark Rothman, who were the characters, the writers who created those two characters. They said, "Well, we need a show." So they did a kind of a presentation film using stuff from their Happy Days appearances, and Mr. Eddie Mecca was the only other character seen in that presentation film. And it was a couple little scenes that showed up in the first episode. And Penny said, we need two things. We need writers, and we need maybe a couple of other characters that are not so much, what we have here. So Penny said, you guys do those guys. Because David and I have been doing those guys since we met in our teens. We had always done those characters under various names, but never commercially. We did toward the end of the Credibility Gaps run. We actually did a couple of Lenny and Antony pieces. And so Penny said she threw a party to celebrate the selling of this show. And some of the producers were there, and she invited us. And at one point, Rob Reiner, who was married to Penny at the time, just turned to us and said, go ahead. Do it. Go do it. Didn't have to say anything more than that. He just kind of sat back. And we did about 15 minutes that we had never done before and that we have never done again, never used again, of the two guys discussing whether they should go to Butler School or not. that's all we had. And it was like we had the right house. Everyone dug it. And so that Monday we came in and Gary said, okay, we'll hire you as writers, apprentice writers, because you're not in the guild yet, but we'll do whatever they have to do, you know. And maybe we'll try and work those characters in. So we wrote ourselves into the first show.
Of course.
Because we were no dummies. Fantastic. Yeah.
And then I recommend, if anyone, as a supplement to that story, read Penny's book that she just did last year, Mother is Nuts.
I've been saving it.
It's so good.
Oh,
it's
she's so awesome. Good. She's a queen. Really is. She's
fantastic. But it pretty much was, did you feel the effects of, is it one of those things where on Thursday night we were on television and on Friday it was crazy?
Well, a little bit. Lowell Ganz is a lovely guy, and he was one of the creators of the show, and he's gone on to write a lot of, you know, big movies and anyway, really nice guy. And so he came the next day. The overnights were ridiculous. We were the number one show of that. So we were the number one show of that week. So when the weekly ratings came out, which I guess was Wednesday, the next day, we were number one for the week. And I've never seen Lowell more worried. His face had fallen, even kind of a lugubrious look to him anyway. But he was like, I don't know what this terrifies me. And I said, why on earth would it do that? Well, what if everyone saw it and hated it?
And then they're not.
He really had no good answer for it, but it was because he couldn't really describe the worry. But I thought it was a pretty good sign. And the fact that we were, you know, Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley were one and two, you know, for like 3 years was a very good thing. But I looked so radically different in my regular life than I did on TV that I didn't get recognized. It didn't, you know, there wasn't like this sudden turn of the page like happened with, you know, people like Robin, you know,
right.
Because Robin and Mork look pretty much the same,
right?
You know, and I'm sure he couldn't go out on the street. Penny too, you know?
I mean, it really, I remember watching, I mean, I would watch the Happy Days Laverne mm-hmm. and Shirley combo.
Yeah.
And I also, I remember watching and getting very excited when the door would fly open and it was you guys. Like, there were episodes where I was like, when are you going to get to the, you know? So was there ever a talk of let's spin these guys off or let's?
Yeah. I don't know if they've ever told us or not. We had been on the air 6 times. The show had been on the air 6 times, and the guys were getting really nice response and everything. So immediately, Fred Silverman, who ran ABC at the time, came to Gary and says, spin them off now. So Gary said, okay, we want to spin you guys off. We want to do an army show because nobody's doing an army show. So Lenny and Squiggy in the Army is basically what we wrote it in about – there was a week – we had a hiatus week. So we had shot, I guess, the first – 9 and 6 had been on the air, 7 and whatever. And so we had a hiatus week. So we wrote it and put it on its feet, a presentation film about 15 minutes long with a bunch of additional gags from the first bunch of Laverne and Shirley shows, you know, just in kind of a real clumsy flashback chunk. And we did it and had it done by Friday.
Holy shit.
And so gave it to him. And by Monday, Fred said, no. And that was it. And they went with the show called Holmes and Yo-Yo.
I remember that show with the robot cop.
Robot, yeah, John Shock.
John Shock, yeah.
Yeah, who's a super guy, by
the way. Hang on, how did I miss Holmes and Yo-Yo?
You never saw that show?
Didn't run very long.
No, it was basically like a grizzled detective and he had a robot partner. And
John Shock, you know John Shock is, right?
This sounds amazing.
Well, it wasn't amazing.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so I can't remember I'm remembering it as amazing.
No, we had a couple of jokes that we had later cannibalized elsewhere, you know, that were pretty good. But it was not something I had no regrets at the time that it didn't go, because we didn't think a military show would be all that interesting after a while. And about 2 years down the line, David and I wrote another one where the guys, it was basically Lenny and the Squig Tones,
mm-hmm.
hit the road and... hitchhike from Milwaukee or from L.A. to Newark, which is where Lenny Squiggy might be finding his father or something. Who knows what the story was? I don't remember. But it later became irrelevant. But that was kind of it. It was like a band, you know, traveling. So,
but it's amazing to have been.
They said no to that one.
You said no to that one too.
No, we liked it. We wrote it and we thought, hey, this could be really funny. And we knew the people we wanted to be in it and everything. And so it never got made. They just said, I don't know, these guys are just kind of such losers. We said, yeah, that's right. They couldn't see him at the center. I understand that. It's fine.
But that's why it's so, I mean, to have been on a show and been like fixtures of pop culture, it's very easy for the rest of the business to then go, well, you guys don't need to work ever again because you are just those guys. And now people associate you with those guys. And so, you know, what I really hope people understand is like, years of comedy training and focusing on craft and focusing on character work, it's like the craft of it is always going to bail you out. Like if you get lucky enough to get on a show and then you're just associated and like, well, if you don't really do anything else, then yeah, that's kind of going to be it. But you were able to break through that.
Well, yeah. And I think I got out at the right time, you know, of that. I didn't go right into another series. You know, that time was really sort of interesting. Because it was the last days of Laverne and Shirley. I was barely on the last season. Practically no one was on.
They went to California, right?
Oh no, they'd been to California for 3 years already.
Oh,
last season Cindy was gone, Penny was gone for much of it, I was gone for much of it. I had it in my deal with Gary Marshall. I went to him personally. I said, "Look, if we sell this movie we've been trying to make for 2 years, I got to be out of here." So I actually put it in my he put it in my contract. If Michael McKean's, you know, if they get a go on their Spinal Tap movie, then he doesn't have to do these last six shows or whatever it was. It was an amazing deal. And he did it because he was a good guy and, you know, still is. So anyway, those last days were peculiar. But the best thing was the next two things that people saw me in, Young Doctors in Love and Spinal Tap, neither were anything like what I had been doing on TV. If I had gone into another goofy neighbor thing or, you know, it's like, you know, I'm kind of glad it worked out that way. Because, you know, if I died right after Tap came out, people couldn't say he could only do one thing.
Right.
You know? And there are some people who can do a lot more than one thing, but they feel comfortable doing one thing because there's a check attached. So they keep doing the same thing.
But
which
you,
is fine if you're Cary Grant.
But you need to keep doing different things, right? You feel like you need to keep doing different things.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Better Call Saul is good because, not to, I'm telling you the show is good.
Please.
But it's good for me. It is good, by the way. But it's a really cool thing to do because it's not like anything I've ever done. And it's just a different guy. And, you know, you have a tendency to get into these boxes. I did the Brady Bunch movie.
Yeah, of course.
And I played the anti-Brady. So I got a lot of attention about other movies that were kind of exactly the same kind of guy. The guy, the asshole, who's in has a lot of power and is pushing our heroes around. And,
right.
And I got to the point where I would say, oh, I know where this is going. And I'd go to the back pages just to see what I wind up covered in at the end. You know,
tar feathers,
shit.
Poop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. My instinct was unerring. You know, so I'm kind of glad I didn't kind of fall into that kind of thing again. You know,
that was by the way, rewatched the Brady Bunch not long ago.
And it was pretty funny.
It does hold up.
Yeah,
it does hold up.
It was the most genius way to have covered that as a movie,
right?
Because it hit every single like. It got the people who watched the original series. It got kids to watch it because it was funny and kind of slapsticky, but then there was this weird layer of like bondage adult humor at
then
the
this,
same
like,
time.
Weird time vortex the family's in for no reason,
right?
Yeah, like,
well, and they're the only ones.
Yes,
it was just
and how fucking dysfunctional they were at the core of it.
Beauty of it. I think my favorite part of it is like the whole fact that Marcia is still fixated on Davy Jones.
Yes.
And Davy Jones comes on, but it's 1990s Davy Jones.
Yeah.
Just does the same.
I think that's one of those things where when they're writing that, they go, that doesn't matter. It's funny. Like, it's funny that they don't acknowledge it.
Well, I got to work with Janelise Cox,
Yeah.
Who is always amazing, awesome.
Yeah.
She's just one of those people who just like hooks into this kind of weirdness, you know? I just adore her.
Yeah, so and Gary Cole was amazing.
Oh, Gary.
Well, also, I think Michael might be the last of the movie villains that is his goal is to build a strip mall.
A little section of the 90s.
Like, yeah.
Now the strip malls have been built.
Now we have too many.
Oh, man. It was a funny movie. I haven't seen it since it came out, but I remember liking it.
Why do you think, because, you know, I find that a lot of not necessarily stand-up comedians, but a lot of strong comic actors, improv people, sketch people, also are pretty amazing dramatic actors at the same time, I think. But why do you think that comedy, which I would estimate to be harder than drama, but I'm biased, why do you think that doesn't get the kind of academic recognition of like a tearjerker? It's like, you know, comedy, it's a lot harder to make people laugh.
I don't know. It's just a matter of, you can make people see fluid from their eyes, then you're a genius. But if you just make them wet their pants, then you're kind of working class or something. Right. I don't know. Maybe laughter is as common as it needs to be, you know? I don't know. Who knows? I mean, I've seen gags and heard gags in recorded stuff and read jokes where I was overwhelmed by their intelligence. And I laughed out loud, but I was like more invigorated by their intelligence. But I think in general, people think that comedy is a little dumber, you know?
Clowns.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know. I suppose so, you know, but some are.
Part of it's how subjective comedy is. Like what is funny to someone might not be funny to someone
I think
else.
It's more of a, I think it's kind of what you're saying where it's just, it's not recognized as being elevated. It's like, oh, the commoners, it's like vaudeville. Like, well, it's
maybe
this is these are what the plebs are doing. This isn't high art, you know?
No, I guess so. I don't know. It's one of those things. You know, we don't want to poke the dead frog too many times.
We're solve this. So
we're going to figure this out. Yes. Put the coffee on.
I think you know, Steve Martin and Lily Tomlin made this movie. All of Me.
One of my favorites.
Very funny movie. And one of the most brilliantly funny comic performances of all time. And it's like, why wasn't he nominated for an Oscar for that?
Right.
I think there was something about, oh, that's Steve doing that thing. Half his body is a woman and half his body. Yeah, because that's so easy.
Right.
And I don't know. This is a thousand. And every now and then, Kevin Kline is one of the few I can think of who got for an out and out comedy performance, got an Oscar
for In and Out, right?
No, for Fish Called Wanda. Yeah, exactly. But how many others? How many others for just?
Also, Steve is acting to no one in All of Me because most of it is Lily Tomlin projected in a reflected image. So he's basically just acting at himself.
Yeah. It's kind of a remarkable thing.
For Spinal Tap, how did you guys know? Is there a mountain of footage that no one will ever see?
No, you can find it. Yeah. There's a lot of footage no one should ever see. There was a whole subplot with where they brought another guitarist in to play for Nigel when he leaves the band, and it's this young Turk, who's probably 22, and the guy was really good, really kind of rocking. He had one of those elastic bands on his guitar, elastic strap on his guitar, so he'd kind of like bounce it almost to the floor. And I mean, he had all these tricks and everything. And so it's me trying to like be the alpha male on stage with this guy, and he's just playing the shit out of me, and I'm just and I come up behind him at one time to share the microphone. He bangs me with his guitar neck, you know. So there was a couple of, and they weren't like great. They didn't have the same, you know. They weren't as useful. There's a whole subplot with Cherie Curry of The Runaways, mm-hmm. where she plays a girl named Stella Zine, lead singer of The Dose, which is this kind of punk band, and she's the one who gives us all the little coal sores.
Oh!
So there's that whole plot, but her whole plot had to go for time because introducing In and Out, it wasn't that much to it. It was just we see her on stage looking really hot and doing this number and at a sound check, And all the guys are, I'm going to have some of that. So we all wind up with the sores, except for the drummer. He's the only one.
But
he's
the beauty of that is that joke still works. Plays throughout
right.
the movie.
So yeah. How do you know when you have that much, you know, and I guess this is, you know, expanded to the subsequent Christopher Guest collaborations, but, you know, when you kind of have your framework for what you're doing, and I'm assuming you're improvising a good chunk of it, right? Most or all of it?
There are four or five written lines in the movie, and everything else was improvised. There were, of course, names of things and, you know, certain reference punch lines, you know, like my love pump didn't come quite right out of the air. That was the part of the construction of the joke in that case. But all the dialogue was improvised.
Yeah. So a lot of the writing almost happens in the post-production process, right? Because you're trying to build you're trying to take all of the shit that you guys did in the moment and figure out how does this lay out as a story.
Rob had about 80 hours to work with.
Jesus.
Now if you shrink it even a little bit, it's because there are two, sometimes three passes at each scene.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it was, we tried to do it real time. We didn't rehearse, but we kind of knew what the essentials of the scene were, and we just plowed through them. And then what you're left with, if you have 80 hours and you want to get it down to about 90 minutes, you have to start throwing huge chunks out and just saying, well, we can't do that, we can't do that. There's no way this happened before here because this and this. Oh, God, we didn't think of that. So all those compression things. I mean, Rob edited for close to a year.
Jesus.
And we saw a lot of different versions of it. We saw the 2.5-hour version, which was, you know, kind of hard.
Are you not even, so at that point when you're seeing the 2.5-hour version, are you going, what the fuck did we do? Like, are you not seeing the movie?
No. We knew it was there.
Okay.
We knew it was there. And we God bless Rob that he actually sat with Bob Layton and did all that. Bob Layton, who's also, I believe, edited every single one of Rob's other films.
Wow.
And he's worked with Chris, too. And
editors, I feel like, I've said this a lot, editors rarely get all the credit that they deserve.
Absolutely right.
Because they really are an additional writer on a film, because they have to make everything play. And they control, you can do the best comedy take in the world, but if the editor doesn't catch it at the right time, then it's not.
By the same token, a director who doesn't give an editor choices and room to move is doomed to his own work.
Yeah,
you know, and they're not always perfect. You know, if a guy delivers just a handful of shots in a scene that the editor thinks, geez, we need a lot. You don't have this. You have him over her, but not her over him. You know, and it's like that, because he has to make it a movie. He has to make the cinematographer and the director's work into this movie. You know, it is an incredibly hard job. But I remember when I was about 15, I saw a movie called The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. Do you know this film?
Mm-mm.
Amazing English film by Tony Richardson with Tom Courtney and Michael Redgrave. And it's just rocking movie. And it's the movie where I saw what a director does and what an editor does together. It's a great lesson. I mean, it's nothing but lesson. It's a great, great movie anyway. Break your heart. But what it really has is this kind of, oh, that's what a director does. Ah, that's what an editor does. And it's like amazing. It's a great experience. So,
is that anything that you... Do you see that and go, that makes me want to direct? Or you go, that makes me not want to have to direct?
No. Directors don't get enough naps. I've done a little bit of directing. You know, I directed a bunch of Tracy Ullman's shows, HBO shows, and I directed a handful of spots for IFC and a bunch of episodes of Dream On.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it. And one episode of Laverne and Shirley a long time ago. And it's not something I pursue. You know, if somebody jumps out with something that sounds interesting, I'd say fine. But it just, you know, the only couple of times I've sniffed around doing that, I haven't been very enthusiastic about it because it's just, you know, it's incredibly hard, and you really do give up minimum 2 years of your life, you know. And I'm running out of 2 years.
Yeah. Well, Dream On, by the way, so far ahead of its time, that show. I feel like Dream On had the spirit of what internet like what internet videos are, which is sort of the dropping in the footage to create the subtext to illustrate the subtext of the scene and the quick jumps and the and that was if people haven't seen that it was early HBO early 80s of was it was early 80s or mid 80s
late 80s
was it late 80s
late 80s yeah
but it was early in there we're gonna make scripted television thing.
It's
instead
around the time
of show
of,
movies.
I remember that and Herman's Head being on at the same time.
Right. That was the beginning of Fox, Herman's Head.
Yeah.
Well, do you know why Dream, how and why Dream On got created?
No.
Universal? I'm thinking Universal. It might be another studio. I believe it's Universal, had all this footage, all these TV shows that they had done, and a lot of movies that they had done that were not in packages that were shown on TV, and they weren't being shown anywhere, and they were in danger of becoming public domain. So somebody at Universal said to John Landis, can you think of anything to do with that? And he and Kevin Bright and David Crane and Marta Kaufman, thank you, they said, how about this? And they put together this show where this guy watched a lot of TV when he was growing up, and he flashes back to these moments. Do it. So all those, that's the reason it existed to begin with.
Wow.
Brian Benben, right?
Brian Benben.
And it was like the first kind
of... And Wendy Malick.
Who
has the best eyebrows in show business. She does.
She was great on that. Was she his ex-wife on the show?
Ex-wife on the show.
And so as a comedy fiend, which I was, it was basically watching a really fun, smart, single-camera sitcom that moved really fast and occasionally had boobs on it.
Yes.
Because
yes,
it was
did.
On HBO.
You gotta have a boob.
Yeah, yeah. When the ones I directed, we actually had flashing auditions, boob auditions. I feel worse about that than almost anything I've ever done in show business. And it was just, we'd get to the end of the interview, thank you. And someone else, not me, would say, may we see your breasts? And the girl would you know, toss them out there.
And you must have felt like, is this illegal?
No. I knew it was like, they explained that they had to do it, and some of the times they've been stung,
right?
You know, on the day.
Right.
You know, and it was never my favorite part.
No,
I love boobs, don't get me wrong.
But it's sort of like, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a strange breed.
There are some directors who literally go into directing so that when they tell people to take their tops off, the girls will take their tops off.
Those people are called Michael Bay. All of them.
You mean not just two?
No.
I got you. All right.
Of all of the... Are there things that you kind of think of as your favorite things that you've worked on that maybe aren't as mainstream or maybe that people that you would want people to go check out if they haven't seen it?
There's a lot of things that people can't check out anymore, you know, because I've been working on the stage. The last 12 years, I've done a ton of stuff on the stage. And you know, it's kind of hard to talk about. I can't say folks run right out and see me in our town at the Barrow Street Theater because I'm not there anymore.
Right.
But for 2 months, I did that play, this kind of great American play at the Barrow Street. It was just David Cromer's production from Chicago. And a lot of amazing actors in it, and I got to be the stage manager part, which is this huge part. I learned it in 8 days.
Jeez.
This immense part, and it was not a perfect thing the first week or so, but it's as good a play as there is, and it was such a great production. But stuff you can actually see,
yeah.
I don't know. I like. Recently, I really loved the show that Chris did, Family Tree, Chris did with Chris O'Dowd and you know, all these amazing actors, and I really loved doing that. You know, didn't find a home on HBO. It was probably the wrong approach, but who knew? I think you have to have more blood, titties, and puke,
to be
on HBO,
right?
But which is not bad.
No.
Not a bad.
Because the audition process is, you know.
That's exactly.
Could you now throw up on your breast, please?
Or there will be blood. Yeah. I still am amused by Tap when I catch a piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people talk to me about Clue because they grew up with Clue.
Clue has a big following.
Yeah, and it's 30 years now. So when I, you know, when we did that film, it came out, it was a disastrous flop. Jonathan Lynn did not work for 2 years. The guy who directed didn't work for 2 years. You couldn't get another job.
I mean, what a cast, though. What an amazing collection of people.
And boy, did we have fun lunch.
Could you just have any Madeline Kahn stories?
Just that she was kind of awesome. She was kind of great. And she would every now and then she'd launch into something. I was staying at my friend's cabin up in the woods, up in the Catskills. And I was looking through her drawers, which were all empty, of course, so she doesn't use the place very much. And I opened up and I said, what are these little chocolate candies doing in there? And I closed the drawer and then I thought, oh, those are mouse duties. And that was the whole story. And it was hilarious. I know, it's not even a very good Madeline Kahn impression. But God, that made us laugh. She was just, she was awesome.
Yep.
Eileen, too, man. Eileen Brennan was just, she was a really funny actress and kind of a great, whatever she did, she just took a big bite of it and she was just amazing. It's shitty that they are dead.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you work with all these great people and then sometimes you know, long after you've said goodbye to them, you know, they kind of stay in your life and then everybody has to say goodbye eventually. Let's not get on this.
No, we don't have to get on this.
No.
But it is, you know.
I was lucky to have worked with Madeline Kahn and Eileen Brennan for 10 weeks. It was fabulous. And Marty Mull and Chris Lloyd.
That was only a 10 weeks. That was 10 weeks.
Yeah, it might have gone a little bit over.
Wow.
We were hired for 10 weeks. I know that. But it wasn't much longer than that.
Wow.
First of all, we never had to go anywhere. The whole set was on stage 8, I think, at Paramount, which I could get to in my sleep at that point, you know. And we had a real pool table. So we'd get to the end of a take, you know, cut. And me and Marty Mull would look at each other, just a little nod, and then we'd
just go off and play pool.
Retire back to the billiard game.
Do you ever get nervous? Because you've done so many things that were influential to people. Do you ever get nervous meeting anyone? Like, do you ever kind of get like comedy nerd thing or?
Yeah, I guess so. But you know, I the card I play is pretty unthreatening. I know that I'm not just some guy. Oh my God, it's not going to be that. You know, but if it's somebody I admire, I tell them right away. You know, and I do. If I run into people I really admire just on the street, I see them on the street, I have to say something, you know, and I hope it's not too nerdy to do that. But my wife saw Eli Wallach on the street about year ago and went up to him, and said, I have to tell you how lovely I think you are. And I just, you know, and he said, thank you very much. It's very sweet. And then he passed away and she said, when he died, Annette said, I am so glad that I went up to him and said that because kicked anything down the street or anything. It was just a happenstance for him, but for her, it was a big thing to have done that. So I try never to skip that if I possibly can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who can you think of anyone that you've seen that you said hi to? Because people must have the thing where they go, oh, but you're, and then they kind of flip it back. I mean, it kind of gives you a nice, you a nice conversation piece because they're probably going to recognize you.
No,
as well.
Not necessarily.
Really?
No. It depends, you know. I can't think of anybody offhand. But if I'm working with somebody that I really admire, I do tell them that. And I do it kind of parenthetically, you know, just so I don't have, so we don't have to go on. If you'd like, I'll bore you to death with how great I think you are. But right now, I'll give you the pocket version, which is lovely to meet you. I've always admired your work, whatever.
Are you still cool with people running up and quoting Spinal Tap at you, which I'm sure must happen pretty nonstop?
If they're not holding a weapon, they're okay. Yeah,
no, because there's really nothing you can say if someone's like, you know, like they start quoting and you'll be like, oh yeah, that was in the movie. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, that was.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not exactly every day, but yeah, it's fine. Doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
People are mainly really nice. So. I don't think so.
I'm pretty nice. I don't know.
Do you have any questions before we let this man get back into his life?
God, I feel like I have a million billion questions. By the way, I just want to say I'm sorry I somehow missed the Folksman opening for Spinal Tap in my life. I will never get that moment.
Well, I think we did it about maybe 6 or 7 times total.
It was great.
Yeah, it was fun.
You're very fun. Good, by the way, guitar player.
Oh, thank
player.
You, thank
very
you.
Very good guitar player. I do well, watch him play guitar.
I keep my head above water.
Yeah. Very good.
Is okay. it? Are you a? Would you consider yourself a? An actor who plays guitar, or are you a closet? Like, no, I'm a guitarist, and I just act so that I can play guitar.
I think if we go all roots about this, I have to say that I wanted to be an actor and assume that was my A game very early when I was about 14. Around this time, I got a guitar and started playing, but I so sucked that I didn't think this would be something I could ever do. And it's not, I couldn't be a session man. I'm not one of those guys, you put a piece of sheet music in front of me and I nail it and pick up my check. I couldn't do that. And I'm a pretty good improviser, but I'm not like a guy who can just go play all night. Name your favorite guys who can play all night.
Sure.
You know, what I really love is, and I bow to no one, is Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
I have this Pearl Jam channel on my radio and on my Sirius.
Yeah.
And I go, these guys, and I'd heard a lot of their live stuff. Remember they released every live show and this one. I bought at least five of those, you know, and it's like, I said, well, if I have a pet band, it's probably, I love the Chili Peppers and I love bands that aren't together anymore. You know, I still like Creedence. I listen to Mike Bloomfield.
I thought you were
going to
say Creed for a second there. I was going to be very worried.
Cream?
Creed.
Oh, Creed. No. No, Creed's Clearwater.
Creedence,
yeah.
Yes, Creedence.
But Cream
no.
also.
Cream is
Cream
okay.
Cream also
Cream
great.
The Who and the Kinks. I'm, you know.
Do you know Patrick Warburton?
I know, I never met him.
You haven't?
No, he's a big music...
Pearl Jam guy.
Oh, yeah? Is
like
he really?
You mentioned one thing, like, that was Pearl Jam 93.
Yeah.
Like, he knows every Pearl Jam, everything.
Well, I was an early fan, and then it was sort of like, I just kind of was out of it for a long time and didn't... I only bought records by dead people. or defunct combos.
Do you have time and energy in your life for new music, new bands, new stuff? Or are you sort of like, you know, I kind of am just cool with the...
Oh, it depends on if something jumps out at me, you know, if I just discover somebody... Or if someone who I kind of remember from a long time ago is suddenly releasing a lot of new stuff and it's really interesting. There are artists who keep making new music. Every time Tom Waits puts out an album, it's kind of new music because no one else is touching that.
Right.
You know, no one else really goes where he goes. And it's so, and you know, there's, and, but, you know, I hear like a really good pop singer like, let's say Lake Street Dive, you know them?
No.
Oh, this girl, Rachel. Oh, okay.
Lake
Street Dive.
All right. Look it up.
He's looking it up.
Oh, hell. Yeah. I feel terrible. I don't remember her name. It's something like Rachel Waters, something real simple.
Is it?
Rachel Price, who is a killer vocalist. So I just heard her on the radio one day, and I said, oh, what's this? And they said, Lake Street Dive, and... You know, they didn't have any major releases out, but I caught a thing on the a nice little thing of them doing a street corner version of I Want You Back by Jackson 5. And I said, oh, there's something there. And so that's nice when that happens, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't really scan everything. I don't listen to the top five things that Shazam tells me to every day, you know?
Right.
Just because, generally speaking, it's not for me. It's for people, you know, who are younger and just into other stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But then, you know, I listen, I like Bruno Mars. I had no idea who he was. And then he's like, this guy puts on a great show and he can really sing.
The thing last year was...
The Witch?
The Super Bowl performance he did last year.
It was
year.
Fabulous.
That was amazing.
Yeah, it was great.
It was really good.
So it's like, it's good that people are still working and doing their own thing and also mining you don't mine Rock's rich tapestry. What do you do to it? Unravel it and put it in your pockets.
You tear that shit up.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You make a new one.
Yeah.
So a couple more annoying questions and then we'll release you. Are there things left that you still want to do, or like, what do you feel as a performer? Like, oh, I really want to be challenged in this way, or I really want to try this type of thing.
I don't know. I think I've come to love working on the stage more than anything because I kind of love the routine of it. Mm-hmm. I know where I'm going to be at 7 o'clock Tuesday night. And you know, there's that certain kind of age. So I probably, there's a lot of things I haven't done there yet. I'd like to do a lot of, you know, really, really hard stuff. Really, by hard, I don't mean hard to watch, hopefully, but you know, stuff, challenging stuff on the stage, and comedy and drama doesn't really make any difference. It's still the same kind of weird gig. I got a chance to play J. Edgar Hoover in All the Way last year on Broadway with Bryan Cranston as LBJ, and amazing cast. And sometimes if you're in the middle of a gig like that and you're just standing there on stage, you go, fuck, I am so lucky. This is so cool. And because I was, you know, I grew up on Long Island, New York, and I thought, well, I'll probably always live in this house and I'll take the train and I'll do my Broadway show and then I'll come back here. You know, it didn't work out exactly like that. I have an apartment in New York City and I'm kind of the home hive is here. But I get to do that. I get to work on those stages. You know, I'm here too, in Chicago and London, worked a lot of places. And it's just I love meeting audiences one by one. Some of them are horrible. But you have to give them...
Fuck you very much.
You have to do the same show for them.
Of course.
You know?
There are some of those shows where you do want to say at the end, like... I mean, as a performer, of course, you bear most of the responsibility for the success of a performance, but sometimes an audience, and you do want to say at the end, if you ever get the chance to get together as a group again, please deny that opportunity. Please do not congregate.
There's a thing they do at Steppenwolf, which is where we did this play, Superior Donuts, before we brought it to New York. And in Chicago, your final dress rehearsal... Instead of an invited dress, which they have, you know, kind of traditionally, your friends come and so you have a positive audience, whatever, they have vet night. And they get all these guys from all the war vets who are living in the various, you know, facilities for veterans. That's the audience. And they are not the easiest audience.
You like. No.
Now, Superior Donuts had a lot of cursing in it, and it had a fist fight, and a lot of bad guys and a lot of good guys who weren't that good, but were at least better than the bad guys, and you know, and it's kind of a wonderful play, and it's a play that you can dig if you've been alive, you know, for any length of time. It's not about you have to know this. It's a wonderful play. And they told me about what that was going to be, and I said, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, sometimes it gets kind of rowdy. But it was one of the best experiences I ever had for two reasons. One, it was a great way to concentrate on the play because you couldn't take in all that they were saying. But also the fact that by about half an hour into it, they were hooked and there with you and rooting. And when the fight at the end of the thing, it was enormous and it was a big mess and it wore me out every night. But you know, I was 60 years old at the time. And then we took it to New York, we kind of abbreviated it and whatever. So it was this big, sloppy, crazy fight, much bigger guy, and I best him, I win. And it was like I was Rocky for once, the only time in my life, because the audience went nuts. They went crazy. And it was fabulous. Couldn't have been a better dress rehearsal.
And these moments where you're having, because you've gotten to do a lot of amazing things, where you said you were on stage with Cranston and you're doing this play and you have that moment where you go, fuck, I'm so lucky. Do you force yourself to stop and take time and appreciate these experiences as they're happening? Or do you, in retrospect, go, oh, yeah, that was a great experience? Are you able to have the presence of mind in the moments?
When you get to the end of that performance, when the people are filing out, then you allow yourself to say, you know what happened tonight about 9:38? I hit the stink button. It was so good. It was just, you know, nailed it. Excuse me. I just did a short run of The Bandwagon with Brian Stokes Mitchell, Laura Osnes, and Tracy Ullman. Tracy Ullman and I were paired up. It's the third time we'd worked together. And she is one of those people with whom I kind of, our gears kind of mesh, you know?
Yeah.
She's just brilliant and funny and awesome. And a couple of times while we were doing that, because we had a couple of really big numbers together, and a couple of those times I felt that same thing. And coming off stage, I said, yes, yeah, that's it. It sounds so corny, I know.
No, no.
And it's hard to share it without sounding corny, but that's where it's at. It's for me, that's, you know, those are the great pleasures.
That's not corny. Corny is, I think, I've had moments where things happen and I go, I can't fucking believe this is happening right now. And I'm literally like trying to fan molecules onto my face to like, I want to remember every piece of air, every, just trying to grasp onto it as it's, and just like, I feel like I should be doing something else to, but I don't know how else to sponge this experience up.
If I'm in a strange city for a very short period of time and it's beautiful and I always leave that city, even if I'm there for a month, I always leave that city going, well, I completely wasted my visit to whatever city it was because I didn't see absolutely everything.
Right.
I spent a month in London in 2012 and I had been there before and I always, I tried to see everything. I saw a zillion things and I still left with that feeling. I didn't really do that. We beat ourselves up.
You never will see and do everything.
No.
Maybe part of wisdom is not beating yourself up every time.
Very good, Grasshopper.
Oh, thank you. Not good at it, though. Not good at it. Are you better at that now? Are you good at that now?
A little bit better. Yeah. As far as the work on stage and in films and stuff. When I have a good feeling about it, I take the time to say that was a good one. And
how often do you? What is it every so often that makes you and Chris Guest and Harry go, let's put on the wigs and do it again?
It's been really, really difficult because we've been a lot of different places. I've been in New York a ton. Harry's been in London and New Orleans a lot. Chris has been L.A. and all over the place, it's just kind of been hard to do that. Plus the fact it's sort of the last time we did it was kind of, there were a lot of frustrations about it. And, bless our fans. They don't buy a lot,
Oh,
they love us.
Right.
And we had, I thought the last LP really, LP. I'm so sad. The last CD.
You mean reel to reel?
No, I was actually on a cylinder at first.
Put on a wax cylinder.
A wax cylinder.
Young fellow by the name of Bell.
Roll back the rug for a little dance time. No, we didn't know that. But it was redoing. We redid a lot of our stuff just for our own. We should sound better. Were we really copying the first bunch of songs, or were we just adding anything new? So I just didn't think it was, anyway.
Yeah.
If it all works perfectly, there's just so many different elements, and there's three different guys doing three different things all over the globe. So it's just been difficult lately.
Just to sort of wrap up, is there one... This is a really dorky question, and I apologize. But is there is there one element for you that you think makes David St. Hubbins tick? Is there something in him that you go back to when you go, when I'm doing this guy, there's this, and maybe it's maybe there's something that you've never talked about that you know about his childhood that made him a certain way? Like, what is the essence of that guy?
Picture this guy looking in a mirror. And his vanity makes him adopt 100% denial. When he looked in the mirror, he saw Peter Frampton. He saw something that cute. And his dress sense, he was what we call color deaf. It's a guy who feels that if he's perfectly happy with the exterior, that the interior can take care of itself. And his interior, he thinks his interior is very well ordered. In fact, it's just quite empty.
Right.
And he's always piling information in, and he swallows it all, and he can talk at length about pretty much anything without knowing anything. He's a lovely man, really.
Well, but he is in a way. He is because...
He's a romantic.
There's another take on those three characters where they're unbearable assholes and not lovable. That guy that you described could have been a complete dickhead, but still the sort of the empty, clueless, there's something that you're like, oh, but...
It's true. I really hadn't thought about it before, but none of the guys in that band act mean to anyone.
No.
They're the schlemazels rather than the schlemiels. They don't even... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never really thought about it.
It's like the Joe Walsh song where he tells you all these, he's got the Maserati in the house and you feel bad for him because you're like, he doesn't know where he is half the time. He's sort of been swept up by this system that, it's kind of not his fault in a weird sort of way.
Knowing you're delirious and being happy with it is kind of a nice nirvana.
But David doesn't know he's delirious, right? He really feels like he kind of knows.
No, he just thinks he's deep. There's a fine line, as they say.
Who wrote the joke? There's a particular joke in there that always makes me laugh extra hard. It's when the manager says that your girlfriend dresses like an Australian's nightmare.
Isn't
which is
brilliant?
Such a... And because I dated an Australian girl for 4 years and I've been to Australia, so I had a very exact image of what that meant.
Yeah.
But I guess... I think most Americans, maybe not off the top of their head, would know. But that's so fucking funny.
It's great. Tony Hendra.
That was him?
Yes. You know, whether he had ever used it before or not, or since, I have no idea. But yes, he that line came out in the playing of the scene, and it was pretty much nailed it, like you say. Yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me do what I said people do to you on the street, which is quote Spinal Tap
That's
at you.
That's really all right.
And we didn't come up against any topics where you're like, you don't want to know about that. I feel like we did
Yeah, I mean... I'm good with that. You should know that Better Call Saul is going to be on Sunday night.
Sunday, February 8th.
Okay. And the next show is on the next night.
Next night on Monday. So it'll be on at 10 p.m. on Sunday the 8th.
Yes.
In between Walking Dead and Talking Dead.
Yes.
And Monday, Saul moves to Mondays.
So we have the hammock between Walking Dead and Talking Dead.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
We are so smart. I wish it was my decision. No, it's a smart bunch there. I spent a lot of time with all these AMC people up in at Sundance just recently, and they're nice and they're smart. And what more do you want?
Yeah, it's great. And I have every hope that this show is a huge. I mean, for you and for Odenkirk and for Vince and everyone else, I really
and Jonathan Banks
and Jonathan Banks.
Yeah, if you don't mention him, he comes to your house and beats you up.
You know, he for the Breaking Bad finale, we did a little thing from the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and Jonathan Banks was on, and this guy who you think is like. You know, where you think he's like an Easter Island statue, you know, like this unbreakable, like you saw this like sensitive, you know, he's like, if I keep talking, I'm going to get teary. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
You're spongy on the inside.
Yeah. You know who else is like that is Ian McShane.
Oh.
Who is like, who I did a play with in New York. And he's as awesome as you want him to be. But you get that feeling about this guy that he plays so many successfully threatening characters.
Sure.
Scariest guy in the room and everything. He's like, hey, this morning, darling. Good. Had your tea. You know, he's that guy. That's my Manchester accent is pretty sad. But you know, he's kind of that guy. And I remember meeting him for the first time and thinking the same thing. You know, why am I not terrified of you?
Yeah.
But
fucking Al Swearengen.
Yeah, but we were on stage one time, and just it was during Broadway Cares thing. We do collecting for Broadway Cares, Fight AIDS, Equity Fights AIDS. So we do that for 6 weeks or whatever it is, twice a year. So you know, we would take turns, you know, reading the this is why you should give today on your way out, all this stuff at the end of the play, and it fell to me to do it because I kind of had a quick version and I just did it and everything. And then Ian wanted to do one night because he wanted to. And it was great. He was going along really fine. And I tried to throw something in, you know. And he threw me a look, which was the Ian McShane we're all afraid of on television. And I can't do it on the radio, on, you know, audio only. But it was really frightening.
I can picture the exact look.
Yes.
That you're talking about.
Just nailed me from 8 feet away, and I shrank to the size of a pea. Yes.
If you do that to me again, you cocksucker. And then it breaks into this random.
He's the best.
You are amazing, and I am so
Thank
thrilled
you so
to
much.
Have chatted with you for an hour and 15 minutes. And please come back another time if you would like to. It would be amazing to have you back on.
Failing that, I will listen religiously.
Thank you so Enjoy much. Your burrito, everyone.
Okay.
The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
When you're committed to raising the standard, you're bound to ruffle some feathers. At Happy Egg, we like to say we farm differently. But in reality, we produce eggs the way people used to, by partnering with local small family farmers who raise our happy hens on 8 or more acres. Because in our opinion, farming shouldn't be complicated. It should be happy. Choose happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.